This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you are prepping for the Series 65, they have a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and, you know, unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. So check them out at certfuel.com.
Sounds like a solid resource for anyone taking the test.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So let's just jump right in. You know, there is this really persistent myth in the financial world that performance measurement is purely objective. Like, people think evaluating an investment portfolio is, it's like engineering or something.
Right, yeah, like it's a hard science.
Exactly, like you just step on a scale, it gives you a number, and that number represents the absolute unvarnished truth.
I mean, it is a comforting thought, right?
Right.
But it completely falls apart the moment you look under the hood of institutional finance.
Oh, totally.
When you ask a portfolio manager how they performed over the last, you know, calendar year, you rarely get just a simple percentage.
Yeah. No, you get a whole story.
Exactly. You get a highly curated narrative. They're essentially asking themselves, which mathematical lens makes my decisions look the most brilliant?
Right. How do I spin this?
Yeah. The diagnostic waters are just incredibly muddy. And if you do not understand the specific measuring stick they are wielding, well, you are vulnerable to being completely misled.
And that reality, honestly, that defines our entire mission today. If you are listening to this right now, you are gearing up to pass the Series 65 exam, and you are staring down the barrel of the portfolio performance measures section.
Which is notoriously tricky.
Oh, it's brutal. It's a notoriously tricky area. Standard finance textbooks tend to treat these formulas like a phone book, you know, just a dry, boring list of equations to memorize. But human brains, especially if you are prone to distraction, they do not retain phone books.
No, they definitely don't. Memorization is incredibly fragile under pressure. I mean, if you just memorize a formula, one slightly reworded exam question will absolutely shatter your confidence.
Yeah, you just blank out completely.
Exactly. So today we are going to master yields.
Mm-hmm.
We will dissect benchmarks and we will untangle the different types of returns by focusing relentlessly on the underlying mechanics.
We're building a mental fortress here.
Your mental fortress, I like that, yes.
To do that, we are just completely throwing out the textbook approach. We are going to make this math stick using, like, absurd scenarios, a cast of recurring fictional characters, and just a really deep focus on the why. Because if you understand why a rule exists, you do not have to memorize it.
Right. You can just logic your way to the correct multiple choice bubble.
Exactly. So before we can evaluate a massive multi-million dollar portfolio, we have to start at the atomic level, right? We have to understand how individual investments generate cash in real time.
Yeah, the basics.
Right. So we need to talk about the yield illusion and the seesaw effect. Specifically, let's unpack current yield.
Okay. Let's do it.
I always conceptualize current yield through the lens of, like, commercial real estate.
Yeah.
So imagine you buy a commercial warehouse for $500,000.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You sign a tenant, and that building generates $50,000 a year in net rental income. So $50,000 on a $500,000 investment, that is a solid 10% yield.
Yeah, the math holds up there.
Ah.
And it illustrates the core concept perfectly. I mean, current yield is strictly an annual income metric relative to the current market price of the asset.
Right.
So the formula is just the annual income, whether that is a bond's coupon payment or a stock's dividend divided by the current market price. But your real estate analogy, while it's helpful for the initial income picture, it actually breaks down a bit when we transition to the fixed income market.
Wait, really? How so?
Because a warehouse does not have a legally binding maturity date where a corporation guarantees to buy it back from you at a predetermined par value.
Oh, right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. With a bond, the coupon payment is locked in stone at issuance. So if a bond is issued with a 5% coupon on a standard, you know, $1,000 par value, it pays $50 a year.
Every single year.
Every single year. That $50 payment never changes, regardless of what the economy does. Therefore, the current yield of that bond changes strictly because the secondary market price of the bond fluctuates.
Okay, right. Let's go back to the warehouse for a second to illustrate that price fluctuation, because I think it helps. Let's say the local economy completely collapses. The town loses its major factory and commercial property values just plummet.
Ouch. Okay.
Yeah, it's bad. You can now buy that exact same warehouse on the open market for $250,000. But miraculously, your specific tenant still has an ironclad lease and continues paying that $50,000 a year in rent.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
Right. So if a new investor swoops in and buys that building for $250,000 and collects that same $50,000 in rent, well, their yield just doubled. It went from 10% to 20%.
Exactly. The income stream didn't change by a single penny. The purchase price collapsed. And that introduces the fundamental law of fixed income, which is the seesaw effect. Right. Bond yields and bond prices move in opposite directions. Always. They are perfectly inversely related.
So if one goes up, the other goes down.
Exactly. If that $1,000 bond drops in price to, say, $900 in the secondary market, you take that fixed $50 coupon and divide it by the new $900 price.
Right.
So the current yield is now 5.56%. The yield rose simply because the asset went on sale.
Okay. To cement this dynamic, we really need to introduce the first of our recurring characters today. So, listeners, I want you to picture a guy named Discount Dave.
Discount Dave, okay.
Yeah. Dave is a menace to retail margins. He is the guy who spends like 3 hours arguing with a car dealer over floor mats.
Oh, we all know a Dave.
Right. He buys dented cans of soup just to save 12 cents. Dave absolutely refuses to pay retail for anything, and he brings this exact energy to his investment portfolio. Dave exclusively buys bonds below their par value. He loves discount bonds.
Discount Dave is actually the perfect avatar for understanding yield hierarchies. Because when Dave buys a bond at a discount, he triggers a very specific mathematical cascade that the exam tests relentlessly.
Okay, I am going to stop right here and break the fourth wall for a second. If you are listening to this and you're multitasking, come back to me, pause whatever you're doing, and think about this question. If Discount Dave buys a bond at a steep discount, like way below its $1,000 par value, which metric is going to be higher, his current yield or his yield to maturity?
That's a great question.
Yeah. Take a beat. Lock in your answer in your head. Okay. What's the answer?
Well, if you reasoned that yield to maturity would be higher, you grasp the mechanics of the bond market. Yield to maturity, or YTM, is a far more comprehensive metric than current yield.
Why is that?
Because current yield only cares about the annual interest payments. It is incredibly nearsighted. But YTM accounts for the fact that Dave got a discounted asset that is a contractual obligation to return to par value.
Okay, this is the critical piece. Let's say Dave bought that bond for $900. He is collecting his $50 a year in interest, sure. But what happens on the day that bond matures? The issuing company doesn't just hand him back his $900, right?
Sure, they don't. They are legally required to hand him the full $1,000 par value.
Exactly.
So Dave experiences a built-in capital gain. He makes $100 of profit purely from the price appreciation of the bond as it pulls toward maturity.
Just a free $100 because he waited.
Right. And yield to maturity factors in that $100 bonus, spreading it out over the remaining life of the bond in addition to all the interest payments. Therefore, mathematically, the YTM must be higher than the current yield on a discount bond.
So we have a strict ranking order that if you're taking the test, you need to be able to recreate on your scratch paper the second you sit down for the exam. For a discount bond, the lowest number is the coupon rate because that is just based on par. Above that is the current yield because you bought the income stream on sale. And at the very top, the highest number is the yield to maturity because it includes the interest plus that sweet capital gain.
Exactly. And we can flip the script entirely to test the reverse scenario. Let's say we have an investor who buys a bond at a premium.
Like paying extra for it.
Right. Like paying $1,100 for a bond with a $1,000 par value. That investor is guaranteed to lose $100 of principal when the bond matures.
Because they only get $1,000 back.
Exactly. So in that scenario, the entire hierarchy inverts. Yield to maturity becomes the lowest number, because that built-in capital loss drags the total return down. Current yield sits in the middle, and the original coupon rate is the highest.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. But what if an investor just buys a newly issued bond exactly at par value, like $1,000 in, $1,000 out?
Then there is no capital gain and no capital loss to account for. In a par scenario, the coupon rate, the current yield, and the yield to maturity are all identical. They sit in perfect equilibrium.
Now, here is where examiners prey on lazy studying. This is where the exam tries to get you.
Yeah.
They know test takers confuse these yield metrics with broader return calculations. I have seen countless candidates blow up their practice exams because they treat current yield like a comprehensive performance metric.
It happens all the time.
Current yield is strictly, entirely, exclusively about income. It is completely blind to capital gains, it ignores capital losses, and it does not give a single thought to the time value of money.
It really is a narrow lens.
Yeah. So if you are presented with a scenario on the test where a stock pays a tiny dividend, but its share price triples over 5 years, and the question asks you to identify a total return metric, current yield is the trap answer. Do not fall for it.
No, do not. It is the equivalent of evaluating a corporate job offer by only looking at the annual Christmas bonus and completely ignoring the base salary and the stock option.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, it is a dangerously incomplete picture. Current yield tells you what the asset is throwing off in cash today. It does not tell you if the investment is actually growing your overall wealth.
Which provides the perfect bridge to our next major concept. Because once you calculate that an asset or an entire portfolio returns, say, 10% for the year, you are left with a burning philosophical question. Is 10% actually good?
Right. Compared to what?
Exactly. If you made 10%, but the broader market was up 30%, well, your manager failed you. Context is everything in finance, and that requires a measuring stick. So we have to dive into benchmarking and the inviolable apples to apples rule.
This is where things get really interesting.
Yeah, to anchor this concept, we need our second character. Listeners, I want you to visualize Manager Mary.
Manager Mary, all right.
Mary is hyper competitive. She runs a boutique mutual fund. She survives on like triple shot espressos. She drives a profoundly impractical red sports car, and her entire identity is wrapped up in beating the market. Specifically, Mary manages a small cap equity fund. She buys tiny, volatile, high growth companies.
Manager Mary is going to be our perfect case study in why benchmark selection is not just a matter of preference, but a matter of strict professional integrity.
Yes.
But to evaluate Mary's claims of genius, we first have to establish the landscape of the indices themselves. The Series 65 demands that you know the specific construction and purpose of the major market benchmarks.
Okay, let's survey the territory. The most famous measuring stick on the planet is obviously the S&P 500.
Right. The Standard & Poor's 500 tracks 500 of the largest publicly traded companies in the United States. It is the universally accepted proxy for the large cap U.S. equity market. Mm. If you are running a fund that buys blue chip giants, this is your benchmark.
Okay, but then we have the territory Manager Mary operates in, right? The Russell 2000.
Correct. The Russell 2000 tracks 2,000 small cap domestic companies. These are the smaller, nimbler, but significantly more volatile companies that fall beneath that large cap threshold.
What if a client wants a benchmark for absolutely everything? Like, they want the broadest possible measure of the U.S. stock market, all the way from the mega caps down to the tiny micro caps.
So the total domestic market, you use the Wilshire 5000.
The Wilshire 5000.
Yeah, it is a slight misnomer today because it actually tracks slightly fewer than 5,000 stocks due to mergers and delistings, but its mandate is to represent virtually the entire publicly traded U.S. equity landscape.
Got it. Now let's cross the oceans. If I am investing internationally, I'm usually looking at the MSCI EAFE.
Right. Yeah. EAFE is an acronym that stands for Europe, Australasia, and Far East. The critical distinction for exam purposes here is that this index tracks developed international markets, but it explicitly excludes the United States and Canada.
So no US or Canada?
None. It is your benchmark for developed foreign economies like Japan, the UK, and Germany.
Okay, and finally, leaving equities entirely, what is the measuring stick for the bond market?
The industry standard there is the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, which professionals almost exclusively refer to as the AG.
The AG.
Right. It is a broad-based index that covers the investment-grade, dollar-denominated, fixed-rate, taxable bond market.
Okay, so identifying the indices is the easy part. Where this gets fascinating, and honestly where the test writers set their most elaborate traps, is in how these indices are actually constructed. Like, they are not just simple averages. We have to discuss weighting methodologies.
This is a vital mechanical distinction. The vast majority of modern indices, including the S&P 500, the Russell 2000, and the Wilshire 5000, they are market capitalization weighted.
Let's translate that. Market cap weighting means that a company's influence on the index is directly proportional to its total overall size. Like, if you take all the outstanding shares of a company and multiply them by the current stock price, you get the market cap.
Right, the total value of the company.
Yeah. So if a $2 trillion tech behemoth goes up by 5%, it is going to physically drag the entire S&P 500 upward with it.
Absolutely.
But if a tiny $5 billion company in the S&P goes completely bankrupt and its stock drops to zero, the overall index will barely register the impact. The giants dictate the movement.
And that methodology makes intuitive economic sense, right? A $2 trillion company represents a vastly larger share of the actual U.S. economy than a $5 billion company. So its stock performance should naturally carry more weight in a macroeconomic benchmark.
Right, that makes logical sense.
But not all indices follow this logic. We have to discuss price weighting.
I am so glad we are getting to this, because price weighting is one of the most absurd, archaic concepts still actively used in global finance, and the exam loves to test if you know its quirks.
Oh, they do.
So the most famous price-weighted index in the world is the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the DJIA. In a price-weighted index, the actual underlying size of the company is completely ignored.
Ignored entirely.
The only thing that dictates a company's influence on the index is its raw per-share stock price.
It is basically a mathematical relic. I mean, it was created by Charles Dow in 1896 because, quite frankly, they didn't have computers.
Right.
The easiest way to calculate a daily market average by hand back then was simply to add up the share prices of a dozen industrial companies and divide by 12.
Right. In the Dow Jones Industrial Average, Company B, the tiny regional player, has 50 times more influence over the index's daily movement than the trillion-dollar global titan, simply because 500 is 50 times larger than 10.
It defies all modern portfolio theory. It really does. Yet the Dow remains a ubiquitous psychological benchmark for retail investors watching the evening news. For the Series 65, you must firmly categorize the DJIA as price-weighted.
Yes, write that down.
If a question asks which index can be disproportionately skewed by a stock split...
Because a stock split lowers the nominal share price without changing the company's value,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. If they ask that, the answer is the Dow.
So bringing this back to manager Mary, picture this. Mary kicks open the door to your advisory firm. She slams her espresso on your desk and she proudly announces, "My small cap growth fund returned 15% this year. The S&P 500 only returned 10%. I crushed the market. I am a genius."
Classic Mary.
Yeah. So here is my direct question to you, the listener. Why should you, as a fiduciary advisor who actually understands performance metrics, immediately roll your eyes at Mary's claim? Think about the underlying assets. Take a second.
Well, Mary is violating the apples-to-apples rule. She is engaging in benchmark mismatching.
Explain that.
Mary's mandate is to manage small-cap stocks. Small-cap stocks are inherently riskier, more volatile, and historically, they require a higher premium to justify investing in them compared to large, stable, blue-chip companies.
Right. They bounce around a lot more.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Mary took on a tremendous amount of small-cap risk to generate that 15% return. But then, to make herself look like a genius, she compared her performance to the relatively safer, less volatile, large-cap universe of the S&P 500.
It is literally like a middleweight boxer dropping down a weight class, knocking out a lightweight, and then claiming they are the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world.
That's a great analogy.
It is the wrong arena.
Precisely. To honestly evaluate Mary's performance, she must be measured against a benchmark that mirrors her specific investment style, her asset class, and her risk profile. For a small-cap fund, her measuring stick must be the Russell 2000.
And what if the Russell 2000 did better than her?
Well, if we look at the Russell 2000 and see that small cap stocks collectively surged 20% that year, Mary's 15% return is no longer a victory. It is a massive failure.
She actually lost to the market.
Yeah, she took small cap risks, but she underperformed her specific market segment by 500 basis points.
Wow. So the takeaway for the exam is that benchmark selection is rigid. A small cap manager goes with the Russell 2000. An international equity manager goes with the MSCI EAFE. You cannot cherry pick indices just to flatter your marketing brochure.
No, you definitely cannot.
But this leads us to a deeper problem. Let's say Mary actually acts with integrity. She compares her small cap fund to the Russell 2000. The index returns 10% and Mary returns 12%. She beat her appropriate benchmark. Does that definitively prove she is a skilled manager?
Not inherently, no. Because outperforming a benchmark is incredibly easy if a manager decides to act recklessly.
Wait, how so?
Well, if Mary takes her client's capital, goes to the bank, and borrows heavily on margin to artificially juice her buying power, she can easily magnify her returns in a bull market and beat the Russell 2000.
But she is exposing her clients to catastrophic downside risk to do it. If the market turns, that leverage will wipe out the fund.
Exactly. This is why raw returns, even against a proper benchmark, are insufficient for evaluating a portfolio manager. We have to introduce the concept of risk adjustment.
Okay, risk adjustment.
We have to mathematically answer the question, was the extra return you generated actually worth the extra risk you subjected my capital to?
That brings us to one of the most historically dense and heavily tested areas of the Series 65, adjusting for risk. We are going to put two heavyweight metrics in the ring together, the Sharpe ratio versus alpha.
Two very different beasts.
Yeah, both of these formulas exist to measure risk-adjusted performance, but they perceive the concept of risk in fundamentally mechanically different ways. Let's dissect the Sharpe ratio first. It was developed by Nobel laureate William Sharpe, and its formula is beautifully logical once you break it down into plain English.
Yes, the mathematical formula for the Sharpe ratio is the return of the portfolio minus the risk-free rate divided by the standard deviation of the portfolio.
Okay, let's slow that down. Let's analyze the numerator first. The portfolio return minus the risk-free rate. I call this the why bother premium.
The why bother premium, I like it.
Because, think about it, the risk-free rate is universally represented by the yield on a short-term U.S. Treasury bill. So let's say a T-bill is yielding 3%. That 3% is what you get for taking absolutely zero risk. You could stay in bed all year, and the U.S. government will hand you 3%.
Guaranteed.
Right. So if you take your money out of that safe harbor, throw it into the chaotic stock market, and generate a 12% return, you don't really take a risk to make 12%. You took a risk to make the extra 9% above what you could have had for free. That 9% is your excess return.
That excess return is the top half of the Sharpe ratio. Now we must divide that excess return by a unit of risk. The Sharpe ratio specifically uses standard deviation as its denominator.
And standard deviation is a big deal here.
It's a huge deal. This is where candidates must pay absolute attention. Standard deviation measures total risk.
Total risk.
Yes. It captures the complete spectrum of volatility and asset experiences. It accounts for macroeconomic shifts, like inflation data or interest rate hikes. But it also captures highly specific localized events, like a company's CEO being indicted for fraud or a critical manufacturing plant burning to the ground.
Right. It measures the total turbulence of the flight, regardless of what caused the bumpiness.
Exactly. It's the full picture of the volatility.
Okay. Now, let's put Sharpe on pause and contrast it with alpha.
Alpha approaches risk from a completely different theoretical foundation. Alpha is tethered to the capital asset pricing model, or CAPM. The formula for alpha is the portfolio's actual realized return minus its CAPM expected return.
So it's actual minus expected.
Yes. But to understand alpha, you have to understand how CAPM calculates that expected return. CAPM uses beta as its measure of risk, and beta only measures systematic risk.
Right. Systematic risk is the risk of the entire system. It is the risk that the overall market crashes. It is a global pandemic. It is a sovereign debt crisis. Systematic risk is unavoidable. It is baked into the economy.
Yes, you can't escape it.
But notice what beta completely ignores. Unsystematic risk. Beta does not care if one specific factory burns down.
And there is a profound theoretical reason why CAPM ignores unsystematic risk. CAPM operates on the assumption that a rational investor holds a fully, broadly diversified portfolio.
Okay, explain that.
Well, if you own 500 different stocks, the risk of one specific factory burning down is mathematically neutralized because, on that exact same day, another company in your portfolio just discovered a cure for a disease.
Ah, so they balance each other out.
Exactly. The localized risks cancel each other out through diversification. Therefore, in a fully diversified portfolio, the only risk left that actually matters.
The only risk you should be compensated for taking
is that systematic risk of the overall market.
Okay, let's break this down with a massive pattern interrupt. Listeners, I want you to put yourself in a highly specific, wildly irresponsible scenario right now.
Uh-oh.
Imagine you take your entire life savings, every single penny. You ignore all advice about diversification and you dump your entire net worth into one single highly volatile early stage biotechnology stock.
Please do not do this.
Do not do this. But imagine you did. You are completely undiversified. If you want to measure your risk adjusted return at the end of the year, which metric is appropriate for your portfolio? The Sharpe ratio or alpha? Think about it.
In that scenario, attempting to use alpha would be a catastrophic analytical error. You must use the Sharpe ratio.
Why?
Because your portfolio consists of a single stock. You have not diversified away the unsystematic risk. your life savings are completely exposed to the risk of that single biotech company failing its FDA trials.
Right, which is a huge unsystematic risk.
Huge. And beta, which powers alpha, ignores that specific trial risk. But standard deviation, which powers sharp, captures the total risk, including the FDA trial volatility.
So whenever you are evaluating a standalone, undiversified portfolio or evaluating an entire portfolio in isolation, the Sharpe ratio is the only metric that accurately reflects the total risk the investor actually endured.
Perfectly said.
But let's bring manager Mary back. Mary doesn't hold one stock. She runs a mutual fund containing 200 different small cap companies. She is highly diversified.
Because Mary has functionally eliminated most of her unsystematic risk through diversification, her primary exposure is the systematic risk of the small cap market. Therefore, we use alpha to evaluate her.
Makes sense.
Alpha allows us to ask a highly precise question. Based on the systematic risk Mary took, which is measured by her beta, what return did CAPM expect her to achieve?
Right.
If she generated a return higher than that mathematical expectation, she has positive alpha. That positive alpha represents pure, isolated manager skill. It proves her specific stock-picking ability added value beyond just riding the market wave.
And if Mary has a negative alpha, it means she took on market risk, but her stock picks actually dragged the portfolio down.
Yes.
In a negative alpha scenario, the client would have been financially better off just firing Mary, saving the management fee, and buying a passive index fund with the same beta.
Without a doubt.
Now, listen closely, everyone. I see this trap spring on candidates over and over again. Alpha is not, let me repeat, is not simply the portfolio return minus the market return.
That is such a common mistake.
It really is. If the S&P 500 goes up 10% and manager Mary's fund goes up 12%, you cannot just subtract 10 from 12 and say she has a 2% alpha.
Right.
That is elementary school math, and the examiners will absolutely put 2% as choice A to trick you.
It's a classic trap. To find actual alpha, you must calculate the CAPM expected return first. You have to build the baseline expectation before you can measure out performance.
Okay, walk us through the mechanics of that calculation verbally. How do we build the CAPM baseline?
Let's set the parameters. Assume the risk-free rate on a treasury bill is 3%. The overall stock market generated a return of 11%, and manager Mary's specific portfolio has a beta of 1.2.
And a beta of 1.2 means her fund is 20% more volatile than the baseline market, right?
Correct. So CAPM dictates that her expected return is the risk-free rate plus her risk premium. And the risk premium is her beta multiplied by the market premium.
Okay, let's isolate the market premium first. The market returned 11%. The risk-free rate is 3%. So the extra return the market provided for taking risk is 8%. 11 minus 3 is 8.
Correct. The market premium is 8%. Now we multiply that market premium by Mary's specific risk factor, her beta of 1.2.
Okay.
8% multiplied by 1.2 gives us 9.6%. Finally, we add that 9.6% back to our baseline risk-free rate of 3%.
3 plus 9.6 is 12.6.
Exactly. According to the capital asset pricing model, based on the fact that Mary took on a beta of 1.2, she was mathematically expected to generate a return of 12.6%.
Okay, so that's her baseline hurdle.
Yes. Now, and only now, can we calculate her alpha. If Mary's actual realized return for the year was 14%, we subtract her expected 12.6% from her actual 14%.
14 minus 12.6 leaves us with a positive alpha of 1.4%.
Yes. That 1.4% is the quantified value of her stock-picking genius. She beat the sophisticated, risk-adjusted mathematical expectation.
Okay, so Mary is having an incredible year. She selected the right benchmark, she has a positive Sharpe ratio, and she is generating massive positive alpha. She is the star of her firm.
She's killing it.
She really is. But there is a fatal flaw in this entire performance measurement ecosystem. It assumes a closed laboratory environment. It assumes the manager has total control.
And they don't.
In the real world, portfolio managers have to deal with the most chaotic variable in finance, human clients. And clients behave horribly.
They really do. It's the unpredictable element.
Which brings us to the cash flow clash. We have to dissect the critical difference between time-weighted return and dollar-weighted return.
This is a huge concept for the exam.
To explore this, we need to introduce our final recurring character. Listeners, let me introduce you to Panicked Pete.
Panic Pete.
Pete is a retail investor, and he is Manager Mary's absolute nightmare client. Pete consumes a toxic diet of 24-hour financial news. He sweats profusely whenever the market twitches. Pete does not have an investment strategy. Pete has an emotional reaction function.
Oh, Pete sounds stressful.
His defining trait is catastrophic market timing. Pete will watch a tech bubble inflate for 3 years, feeling massive FOMO, and finally decide to wire $500,000 into Mary's fund on the exact day the market hits an all-time high.
Ouch.
Then, when the inevitable correction happens and the market drops 20%, Pete's anxiety redlines. He logs into his portal, liquidates his entire position at the absolute bottom of the trough, and moves to cash.
Panic Pete is a walking wealth destruction machine. He buys high and he sells low, relentlessly.
Constantly.
From a performance measurement standpoint, Pete creates a massive structural problem. If we just look at the raw cash flowing into and out of Pete's specific account, the returns are abysmal. But Mary didn't make those timing decisions.
Mm-hmm. Pete forced those cash flows upon her. The Series 65 requires you to understand how the industry separates Pete's disastrous behavioral timing from Mary's underlying professional skill.
So we accomplished this using two distinct calculations, right? Time-weighted return and dollar-weighted return.
Exactly.
Let's isolate Mary's skill first. If I am an institutional consultant looking to hire manager Mary, I don't care about Pete's emotional problems. I want to know if Mary is good at picking small-cap stocks. How do I measure her?
You measure Mary using the time-weighted return, or TWR. The defining philosophical characteristic of TWR is that it completely mathematically neutralizes the distorting effects of client cash flows. It is blind to when Pete deposits money, and it is blind to how much he withdraws.
Wait, how does the math actually accomplish that? How do you just ignore a $500,000 deposit?
It utilizes a methodology called chain linking. Let's say Pete makes his massive deposit on March 15th. To calculate the time-weighted return, the accountant stops the clock on March 14th.
Okay, they pause it. Yes. They measure the percentage growth of the portfolio from January 1st to March 14th, based solely on the assets that were in the fund during that specific window. Then, they restart the clock on March 15th with the new, larger capital base and measure the percentage return for the next sub-period.
Ah, so they are essentially breaking the year into a series of mini-performance periods, segmented every single time a client moves cash in or out.
Precisely. Once they have a percentage return for each sub-period, they geometrically link those percentages together to create a single continuous return for the year.
That's brilliant.
By only looking at the percentage growth of whatever capital happened to be present at any given moment, the size and timing of Pete's deposits become completely irrelevant.
So the TWR isolates the performance of the underlying assets. It proves whether Mary's investment thesis was correct, completely untethered from her client's chaotic cash flows.
Exactly. And this metric is so critical for evaluating skill that the Global Investment Performance Standards, GIPS, actually mandate its use. If a mutual fund or a money manager wants to publish their track record in a prospectus or a marketing brochure, they are ethically and professionally required to display the time-weighted return.
It is the only metric that provides a level playing field for comparing two different managers who might have vastly different client bases.
Right.
But wait, we have isolated Mary's skill and she looks great on paper, but what about Panicked Pete? We can't just ignore his reality. He still lost half his net worth. His bank account doesn't care about GPS standards. How do we measure what actually happened to Pete's specific money?
To measure the client's localized actual experience, we must use the dollar-weighted return, or DWR.
Okay.
The exam will often use DWR interchangeably with the internal rate of return, or IRR. They are mathematically equivalent concepts.
Good to know.
The defining characteristic of the dollar-weighted return is that it is hypersensitive to the size and the timing of every single cash flow. It calculates the discount rate that makes the present value of Pete's deposits exactly equal to the present value of his terminal account balance.
Okay, let's frame this with a direct question for the listener. Picture this timeline. On a quiet Tuesday in October, Panicked Pete wires $1 million into manager Mary's fund. On Wednesday morning, the global markets suffer a historic black swan event, and the entire small cap sector drops 30% in a single day.
A nightmare.
Total nightmare. At the end of the year, assuming Mary slowly grinds out decent returns for the next 2 months, whose metric is going to look worse, Mary's time-weighted return or Pete's dollar-weighted return? Pause and think through the mechanics.
Pete's dollar-weighted return is going to be a bloodbath compared to Mary's time-weighted return.
Why is that?
Because Pete deposited a massive concentration of capital the day before a crash. That 30% drop applied to a huge dollar amount. The timing of his cash flow acted as an amplifier for the negative return. His personal IRR is heavily weighted by that massive, poorly timed deposit.
But Mary's time-weighted return shrugs off the size of the deposit. Yes, her fund suffered a 30% drop for that specific sub-period. But because TWR links percentages, it doesn't matter if that drop happened to $1,000 or $1 million.
Exactly.
If Mary spends November and December generating brilliant positive returns on whatever capital remains, her overall time-weighted return for the year might actually look quite respectable or even positive.
The divergence between the two numbers tells the whole story. TWR proves Mary's underlying strategy was sound over the course of the year. DWR proves Pete's timing was catastrophic.
For the exam, you need a mental firewall between these two concepts. Let's build that firewall right now. If a test question asks you how to evaluate a portfolio manager or asks what metric is required for public reporting, the answer is always time-weighted return. It isolates manager skill.
Yes.
If the question asks you how to measure the actual performance of a specific investor or asks what metric accounts for the timing of cash flows, the answer is dollar-weighted return, which is synonymous with internal rate of return.
And it is worth noting, if you have a rational client who puts money into an account on January 1st, makes absolutely zero deposits, makes zero withdrawals, and checks the balance on December 31st, their dollar-weighted return and the manager's time-weighted return will be mathematically identical.
Oh, because the cash flows didn't move.
Exactly. The numbers only diverge when cash physically moves in or out of the portfolio.
Okay, we have isolated manager skill, we have scolded panicked Pete for his emotional trading, but we still need to establish the foundational math of time. Mm. We need to know how to accurately report the raw growth of money over various holding periods.
Yes, the math of time.
We are moving into the math of time. We need to rapidly define total return, holding period return, annualized return, and expected return. Let's start with the absolute baseline metric of the entire industry, total return.
Total return is the most comprehensive measure of raw performance. It is agnostic to risk, and it is agnostic to cash flows. It simply asks, what did this investment actually generate?
Just the big picture.
Right. It combines all sources of wealth creation. It captures the capital appreciation or depreciation of the asset's price, and it adds in any income generated, whether that is dividends from a stock or coupon payments from a bond.
The actual formula is pretty intuitive. You take your ending value, subtract your beginning value, and add in all the income you received. Then you divide that entire massive numerator by your original beginning value.
Simple enough. But the critical non-negotiable assumption baked into the total return formula is reinvestment.
Reinvestment?
Yes. It assumes that every time you received a $50 dividend, you immediately use it to buy more shares of the underlying asset.
That reinvestment assumption is vital because it triggers compounding. Now, closely related to total return is the holding period return, or HPR. Mechanically, what is the difference?
Mechanically, there is zero difference. The formula is identical.
Wait, really?
Yes, the distinction is purely semantic, relating to the time frame. Holding period return is explicitly the return generated over the specific arbitrary period that the investor happened to hold the asset.
So it could be a 3-day holding period return for a day trader?
Yes. Or it could be a 12-year holding period return for a long-term investor. It makes no attempt to standardize the time frame.
And this is where a massive trap lies. If you are sitting across from a client and they say, my tech fund gave me a 30% holding period return, but your bond fund only gave me a 6% holding period return, so I'm firing you. You cannot let them make that comparison.
Never.
You can never, ever compare raw holding period returns if the time horizons are different.
It goes right back to our apples to apples rule.
Right.
I mean, a 30% return generated over a 10-year holding period is actually a very sluggish, low-growth investment. But a 6% return generated over a 3-month holding period, that is a spectacular, high-octane, annualized run rate.
To compare these two investments fairly, you have to convert them to a standardized unit of time. You have to annualize them. You must express what the return would be if it were sustained for exactly 1 year.
Which brings us to the great mathematical debate of performance reporting. The simple arithmetic mean versus the geometric mean.
Oh, this is a fun one. I am going to make a mathematical argument right now, and I want you to tear it apart. Ready?
Let's hear it.
Let's say I invest $100 in a highly volatile crypto asset. In year one, disaster strikes. The asset drops 50%. I am devastated.
You're down to 50 bucks.
Right. But in year two, the market roars back. My asset gains 50%. So if I calculate my simple arithmetic average, I take my year one return of negative 50. I add my year two return of positive 50, which equals zero. I divide by my 2 years, and my average annual return is 0%. I broke even. My average return is zero.
Well, your simple average is zero, but your bank account is bleeding. You did not break even.
What?
You lost a significant portion of your wealth. And this scenario perfectly illustrates why the financial industry relies on geometric means for multi-period returns rather than arithmetic averages.
Walk me through the pain. Where did my money go?
Let's trace the actual dollars. Yeah. You started with $100. In year one, you suffered a 50% loss. Half of your capital evaporated. You were left with a terminal balance of $50 at the end of year one.
Okay, track that.
In year two, you experience a 50% gain. But this is the critical flaw in your arithmetic logic. Mm-hmm. You are not gaining 50% on your original $100. That money is gone. You are only gaining 50% on the $50 you have left. 50% of $50 is $25.
So I add that $25 of growth to my $50 base.
And your ending balance at the close of year two is exactly $75.
I started with $100. I endured 2 years of massive volatility, and I ended up with $75. I lost a quarter of my wealth, even though my arithmetic average return claims I am flat at 0%.
Precisely. The arithmetic mean structurally overstates multi-period performance because it fundamentally ignores the reality of compounding. It assumes that at the beginning of every single year, your portfolio magically resets to its original starting value. But in the real world, your base capital is constantly shifting.
That is wild.
A geometric mean fixes this. It accounts for the compounding effect by linking the actual growth factors of each period and calculating the corresponding root. If we apply the geometric mean formula to your scenario, it will accurately reveal that you suffered an annualized loss of roughly 13.4% per year. It tells the truth about your shrinking wealth.
It captures the reality of the sequence. Now, the actual geometric mean formula requires taking the nth root of a series of multiplied factors. It is complex algebra. Does the Series 65 expect candidates to calculate deep geometric roots by hand?
Generally, no. They do not expect you to be a human spreadsheet. However, they absolutely expect you to understand the conceptual difference we just discussed. They will ask conceptual questions, proving you know that geometric means are required for multi-year returns.
Good to know.
Furthermore, they expect you to know a simple approximation shortcut for periods under 1 year. If a question states that an asset generated a 4% return over a 6-month holding period, you need to approximate the annualized return.
And the shortcut is just basic multiplication, right? Since there are 2 6-month periods in a single year, you just multiply that 4% return by 2. Your approximate annualized return is 8%.
Exactly. The true, mathematically pure, geometric annualized return would be slightly higher, roughly 8.16%, because it factors in compounding the first 4% gain during the second half of the year. But for the purposes of navigating multiple choice options on the exam, the simple multiplication shortcut will get you to the right answer cluster.
Just remember the cardinal rule. Never take a multi-year total return and simply divide it by the number of years. That is the arithmetic trap, and the exam writers will always include that false number as an option.
Always.
Okay, we have spent all our time looking backward, evaluating performance that has already happened. Let's pivot and look forward. We need to define expected return.
Expected return is not a guarantee. It is a statistical forecast. It is a probability-weighted average of all possible future outcomes for an investment.
I always relate this to meteorology. If you check your weather app and it says there is a 30% chance of torrential rain and a 70% chance of bright, cloudless sun, the meteorologist is giving you a probability-weighted forecast.
Right.
You are not going to step outside on Tuesday and experience 30% rain and 70% sun simultaneously. It is going to be one or the other. But over 100 similar days, that forecast represents the statistical expectation of the environment.
It is a really strong analogy. In modern portfolio theory, analysts build models with various economic states. They might project that there is a 20% probability the economy enters a deep recession, which would cause a specific stock to drop by 10%. Conversely, they might project an 80% probability of sustained economic expansion, where the stock would rise by 15%.
Right.
To find the expected return, you multiply each possible outcome by its assigned probability and then sum the results. You are mathematically blending the optimistic scenario with the pessimistic scenario to arrive at a baseline forecast.
It is a highly educated, mathematically rigorous guess.
Basically, yeah.
All right, it is time for a reality check. We have calculated annualized returns. We have risk adjusted with alpha. We have bypassed panicked Pete with time-weighted returns. And I will admit, these numbers look incredibly satisfying on a Morningstar performance report.
They do. It is elegant math.
But there is a glaring problem. You cannot take a PDF of your time-weighted return to the grocery store and use it to buy a gallon of milk.
Very true.
We have to transition from nominal returns, you know, the raw theoretical numbers on the page, to real, actionable wealth. We have to deal with the two silent, relentless killers that actually destroy your purchasing power in the real world, inflation and the IRS.
The fun stuff.
Yeah, let's tackle inflation first. Earning an 8% return sounds great until you realize the cost of living went up 9%. To find out if you are actually growing wealthier, you have to calculate your real return, which is synonymous with your inflation-adjusted return.
The real return isolates the actual increase in your purchasing power. For the Series 65, the approximation formula is beautifully simple. You take your nominal return, the raw percentage your account grew, and you subtract the inflation rate, which is usually represented by the Consumer Price Index, or CPI.
So if your bond portfolio yields 7%, but the CPI dictates that inflation is running at 3%, your approximate real return is only 4%. The first 3% of your return was entirely consumed just treading water against the rising cost of goods. You only genuinely increased your wealth by 4%.
There is a more precise, mathematically rigorous formula, which is 1 plus the nominal return divided by 1 plus the inflation rate minus 1. Using that exact formula on a 7% nominal return and 3% inflation yields a true real return of 3.88%.
Oh, wow.
But again, for the vast majority of exam questions, the simple subtraction shortcut is entirely sufficient to identify the correct answer.
The planning implication here is massive for advisors. If you put a conservative retiree into a portfolio of safe government bonds yielding 4%, and the economy enters a period of 5% inflation, their real return is negative 1%. They are losing purchasing power every single day, even though their account balance is technically going up.
Which is exactly why the U.S. Treasury created a specific instrument to combat this exact scenario, TIPS, or Treasury Inflation Protected Securities.
TIPS?
Yes. TIPS are a heavily tested product because they explicitly guarantee a real rate of return, completely neutralizing the threat of inflation.
Wait, how does the mechanism actually work? How does a bond protect against an unknown future inflation rate?
It works by constantly adjusting the underlying principal. With a standard bond, the $1,000 par value never changes. But with TIPS, the principal value is dynamically linked to the Consumer Price Index.
Oh, that's clever.
If inflation rises by 2% over a six-month period, the Treasury physically adjusts the principal value of your TIPS bond upward by 2%. Your $1,000 bond becomes a $1,020 bond.
And since the fixed coupon rate is applied to that constantly expanding principal balance, your actual cash interest payments increase as well. If inflation skyrockets, your principal skyrockets and your interest checks get bigger, preserving your exact purchasing power.
The perfect hedge.
Okay, so TIPS can neutralize inflation. Now we have to face the final boss of wealth destruction, taxes.
The IRS always gets their cut.
They sure do. To determine what a client actually gets to keep and spend, you must calculate the after-tax return.
The after-tax return formula is straightforward. You take your pre-tax return and multiply it by the quantity of 1 minus your marginal tax rate.
So if your corporate bond yields 10% and you sit in a 24% tax bracket, you multiply 10% by 0.76. The result is 7.6%.
Correct.
The government takes 2.4% and you are left with a true spendable return of 7.6%.
The math is simple, but the application is where things get interesting.
Let's bring back our old friend, Discount Dave.
Good old Dave.
Dave has had a fantastic decade. His discount bond strategy paid off massively. He is no longer wearing thrifted suits or buying dented soup cans. Dave is now a high net worth individual, and his massive income has pushed him into the absolute highest marginal tax bracket, 37%.
Wow, good for Dave.
Right. So Dave is currently analyzing two different fixed income options. Option A is a standard corporate bond yielding 5.5%. This bond is fully taxable at the federal level. Option B is a municipal bond yielding 4%. Because it is issued by a local municipality, the interest payments are completely tax-free at the federal level. So here's my direct question for you. How does Dave, or Dave's advisor, mathematically prove which bond leaves more actual dollars in his bank account?
You cannot simply look at the nominal yields, because a 4% tax-free yield behaves very differently than a 5.5% taxable yield. To compare them fairly, to abide by our apples-to-apples rule, Dave must calculate the tax-equivalent yield, or TEY, of the municipal bond.
And what does that tell us?
The tax-equivalent yield tells Dave exactly what a taxable corporate bond would have to yield in order to equal the take-home pay of the tax-free mini-bond.
And the formula for tax-equivalent yield is where candidates constantly make unforced errors. To find the after-tax return, we multiplied. But to find the tax-equivalent yield, you take the tax-exempt yield of the municipal bond and you divide it by the quantity of 1 minus the tax rate.
Yes. The division is the critical mechanical step. Let's run Dave's numbers verbally to see the impact. The municipal bond offers a tax-free yield of 4%. Dave is in the 37% tax bracket. First, we determine the denominator. 1 minus 0.37 leaves us with 0.63.
So we take the 4% tax-exempt yield and we divide it by 0.63. If you run that on your calculator, you get 6.35%.
That 6.35% is Dave's tax-equivalent yield. It means that for Dave specifically, based on his massive tax burden, a fully taxable corporate bond would have to yield more than 6.35% just to match the spending power of the 4% municipal bond.
Since the corporate bond he was looking at only yields 5.5%, the municipal bond is vastly superior for his specific portfolio.
Absolutely. And this reveals a broader conceptual truth that examiners love to test. Municipal bonds become mathematically more attractive as an investor's tax bracket increases.
Let's test that. If Dave was in a low 12% tax bracket, his denominator would be 0.88. 4% divided by 0.88 is only a 4.5% tax equivalent yield. In that low tax scenario, the 5.5% corporate bond would be the better choice.
Exactly. Munis are explicitly designed for and most beneficial to high income earners seeking shelter from heavy taxation. It is the perfect intersection of tax law and investment mathematics. It proves that a fiduciary advisor cannot just chase the highest nominal yield on a screen. They must tailor the portfolio to the specific localized reality of the client's tax return.
All right, take a deep breath. We have mapped a tremendous amount of territory today. We have dismantled yields, we have interrogated benchmarks, we have separated manager skill from client behavior, and we have navigated the real-world friction of taxes and inflation.
We covered a lot of ground.
It is time to lock this in. We are moving to the rapid-fire recap. I am going to hit the 5 most heavily tested takeaways from this entire deep dive. Number 1. Current yield is an income-only metric. It completely ignores price changes, capital gains, and the time value of money. Due to the seesaw effect, if a bond's price drops, its current yield rises. And for a discount bond, yield to maturity will always be your highest metric due to the pull-to-par value.
Spot on.
Number 2, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is dangerously quirky because it is price-weighted, meaning a high-priced stock dominates the index regardless of the company's actual size. Always match your manager's benchmark to their specific style and asset class. Small cap managers must be judged against the Russell 2000.
Don't forget that one.
Number 3, risk-adjusted returns define true manager skill. The Sharpe ratio relies on standard deviation, meaning it evaluates performance against total risk, which is perfect for an undiversified portfolio. Alpha relies on CAPM and beta, evaluating performance against systematic risk. You must calculate the CAPM expected return before you can isolate alpha.
Very testable.
Number 4, the cash flow clash. Time-weighted return isolates and proves manager skill because it mathematically eliminates the distorting effects of client deposits and withdrawals. Dollar-weighted return, which is equivalent to IRR, measures the investor's actual experience because it is hypersensitive to the timing of their cash flows.
Yes.
Number 5, when comparing taxable and tax-free bonds, the tax-equivalent yield formula requires you to divide the tax-exempt yield by 1 minus the tax bracket. Higher tax brackets mathematically increase the allure of municipal bonds.
That is a rock-solid distillation of the core mechanics you will need on test day. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a broader concept to ponder, a scenario that synthesizes several of these ideas into a real-world planning challenge.
Give us a final provocative thought.
We spent a lot of time analyzing Panic Pete and how his disastrous market timing destroyed his personal dollar-weighted return. I want you to project that dynamic onto a concept called sequence of returns risk in retirement planning.
Sequence of returns risk.
Okay. Imagine a client who behaves perfectly. They never panic sell. They reach age 65 and retire. they transition their portfolio from accumulation to distribution, meaning they are now systematically withdrawing 4% a year to buy groceries and pay property taxes.
Sounds like a standard retirement.
Right. But if the broader stock market suffers a massive 30% crash in the very first 2 years of their retirement, they are forced to sell off shares at severely depressed prices just to fund their lifestyle.
Oh, because they still need the cash.
Exactly. Because of the timing of those negative returns occurring simultaneously with their required cash outflows, their personal dollar-weighted return will plummet. The math spirals so violently that they might completely exhaust their portfolio in 15 years.
That is terrifying.
Meanwhile, a mutual fund manager looking at the 30-year time-weighted return for that exact same market period might point to a fantastic positive 8% average return. The abstract math looks beautiful on the manager's desk, but the client still goes broke in the real world. This is why mastering these metrics is not just an academic exercise to pass a licensing exam. Understanding the friction between time-weighted returns, dollar-weighted realities, and cash flow sequencing is the difference between a client retiring with dignity and a client running out of money.
That perfectly brings us full circle. That objective scale we talked about at the very beginning of the show, it doesn't exist. The X-ray machine is broken. You have to know how to navigate the money waters.
You really do.
And now you do. You understand the mechanics, you understand the psychology, and you understand the why behind the formulas. You are armed and ready to conquer the portfolio performance section. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep grinding, trust your preparation, and good luck crushing the Series 65.